And Gary's going to ask you one more time to say on the record that you videotape.
This is Gary Cohen. I'm here with Alexis Simondinger. We are interviewing Kent Feinberg, and we are on the record. We're from the FCIC, and this is you're okay with being taped.
I'm glad to be taped. I'm the former special master for TARP executive compensation at Treasury. I resigned effective last Friday, and I've been replaced by an internal Treasury career, well, not career, but a Treasury official, Patricia Gagan. She is now the acting special master, and she'll be responsible for, under the statute and the regs, issuing compensation determinations for 2011. All of the 2010 determinations were made while I was still there.
Aren't that many institutions left that you'll be covered by it, are there?
That's right. They're down now to four.
Mm-hmm.
AIG, GM, GMAC, and Chrysler. Chrysler Financial, Bank of America, and Citigroup have all bought their way out of mandatory jurisdiction.
It was a tremendous incentive for the chief executives and the other executives to get that to happen. Would you, I guess the topic we want to talk to you about is compensation on Wall Street, and there has been a lot of discussion about whether the compensation practices on Wall Street contributed to the financial crisis, whether the incentive structures were skewed, whether there was proper responsibility or accountability, and so on. And without, you know, without prejudicing what your views are, do you have a sense of, first of all, how in your travels as the special master, do you have a sense of how the compensation structures on Wall Street changed from back when you started practicing law in the mid-70s to the current day?
Yes. I think that's the answer to your second statement. Compensation incentive structures were skewed in the last decade or more. I don't know how far back you want to go. But this notion of guaranteed cash, immediate gratification in terms of compensation, guaranteed incentive bonus payments, no real integration of compensation to company performance institutionally, legally, I think we saw until the financial collapse an evolution in terms of marketplace risk being promoted through compensation programming. I have no idea whether that compensation as a segregated issue contributed to the crisis. I read that it did. I read that it didn't. I do not know. Congress obviously felt that it did because Congress enacted the statute that conferred mandatory jurisdiction of Treasury over compensation practices in some cases. So Congress either felt that there was a causal connection between compensation based on risk and the debacle, or Congress felt at the very least that having bailed out, the taxpayer having bailed out these seven companies, the populist consideration demanded that compensation be reined in by the government. So I don't know the cause. I can't tell you whether compensation contributed to the debacle. I suppose in some sense it did, by definition. But I do know that the compensation structures promoted risk-taking and were not based on a sound relationship between the executive receiving the compensation and company performance.
Do you think that applied across the board, or was it in certain segments of the industry, or can you...
Be very careful, I've learned. Be very careful about painting with too broad a brush. I cannot say, I tell people this all the time, I cannot say that corporate, that compensation practices on Wall Street incorporate in the auto industry, in the Fortune 500, I cannot paint with that broader brush and try and reach conclusions about compensation and how it impacts corporate performance. All I can do is say, look at the company, look at how it pays its key people, and is that compensation structure, should it be subject to reform? I wouldn't go so far as to even paint Wall Street as a monolith, because, first of all, very few companies on Wall Street are under my jurisdiction. And secondly, even the companies that are under my jurisdiction were vastly different in terms of how they approached compensation. So I wouldn't draw any general conclusions about what I've done.
What do you think did you look at the historical compensation structures as part of your... Did you go back as far as the time that many of the major investment banks went from their partnership structure, which they were in the 70s and the 80s, and did you notice or did you look at whether there were any changes in the structure when they became publicly traded corporations?
No. Our mandate was to fix compensation prospectively.
Right.
So in contrast to fixing compensation prospectively, we looked at how these companies performed just before TARP, 2007, 8. Now, we didn't go back pre-2007.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What were the worst examples of, in your view, of misguided incentive structures that you can pick out?
A combination of the following equals the worst example. One, predominant compensation in cash, coupled with two, predominant compensation in cash that was guaranteed, coupled by three, predominant cash that was guaranteed and that was immediately, in quotes, payable. That is the perfect storm, where we concluded time and again that the executive had absolutely no incentive to perform in a way that would promote corporate safety, because that executive had no skin in the game. I can go and invest in Bolivian gold mines. It doesn't matter to me. I'm getting 8 points. Oh, and four, coupled with four, the size. Mm-hmm. Not just the cash, the size. I'm getting guaranteed $4.5 million no matter how the company performs. I'm getting it all this year. And, I want to do a good job, but my compensation is in no way tied to longer-term company performance. To us, that was the perfect example of the worst case.
Well, those would be situations where they would have some percentage based on something, either gross revenues brought in or booked profits. I mean, or would be
not just, even
just flat compensation.
The CEO will hereby receive $4.5 million this year, every 2 weeks. Very truly yours. Mm-hmm. No. The minute you tie that cash to some sort of incentive-based program, you will receive $4.5 million, but only $2 million of it is guaranteed. The other $2.5 million will depend on company performance or profitability or whatever. You're moving away from the perfect storm, and you're starting, it's still a problematic, but you're starting to distance yourself from guaranteed cash without regard to company performance.
Well, one of the things that had come up in the case of AIG Financial Products, and we had Mr. Cassano, for example, he was a witness at our hearings a couple of months ago, and He was asked how much money he had made at AIG, and he said somewhere around $300 million, and it was a collective gasp. And I think his the AIG Financial Products compensation structure was based on, I don't know whether there were minimum guarantees or not, but it was based on a percentage of something. And so the more that they did, the more that they made, regardless, I guess, of how things worked out in the future. And that would seem to be...
That's right. Yeah. Now, with AIG Financial Products, there was it's not the perfect storm. It's just a bad storm, as you said. Mm-hmm. There was guaranteed cash that he received, and then there were milestones where he would receive cash, not stock. He had received immediate cash in the sense that the stock didn't have to vest and didn't have to go over long term. It was milestones. Here's more cash. And... it was based on the generation of revenues that would result in linear. Here are the revenues, you get more cash. Not, here are the revenues, but let's see if the financial products that generate those revenues will survive for 2 years or a safe risk down the road, or are you just collecting your cash now on the basis of bottom line immediate revenue generated. And so instead of it being a perfect storm, instead of a home run storm, it was a triple. Mm-hmm. Very serious problems.
Let me ask you, you by definition, you looked at the firms that got into trouble because they needed...
The most trouble.
The most trouble because they needed the help. So by definition, this was a group that... Was
summa cum laude.
Right.
This was the seven companies...
Right.
That received the most taxpayer assistance to survive.
Right.
By statute, I was limited to these seven.
Right. So let me ask you, was there a control group? Did you look in any way comparatively at those who had not needed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And so is that the basis of some of what you're telling us that you observed? I just want to get an idea of, or was this the norm? This is.
Were there differences in the ones that took the money versus the ones that didn't?
Again, there's no, you can't generalize. What we did is we looked at Bank of America and Citigroup of banks.
Right.
So we looked at them. Then we'd look at Chase, or we'd look at Wachovia, Wells Fargo, and we would see how they paid.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd look back at Citigroup and Bank of America and compare and contrast. Now, very often we found that banks that weren't under our jurisdiction engaged in similar compensation practices. But of course, under the statute, we had absolutely no mandatory jurisdiction over them.
Mm-hmm.
So there was nothing we could do.
So were you able to draw some guesses, extrapolate from that, about what were the factors that related to compensation that got these folks into trouble?
Well,
no.
Again,
you're saying no.
Whether or not these compensation practices that we found to be inappropriate and unsound,
mm-hmm.
whether or not they were responsible in whole or in part for getting them in trouble,
mm-hmm.
as I said 15 minutes ago,
mm-hmm.
that is a question that, I mean, requires economists and everybody to look back at the crisis and say, I had enough challenge trying to figure out prospectively what their pay ought to be
mm-hmm.
without blaming them. The compensation practices for the crisis.
Right.
I do think, quite apart from a causal connection between the crisis and the pay, I do think that the pay practices engaged in by these seven companies that were under my jurisdiction were outrageous.
Okay.
In absolute terms, I don't really care whether they contributed to the crisis before my time.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted and was told by Congress, you decide what's a more appropriate pay package. And we did. Instead of all cash, very little cash. Instead of cash bonuses, stock bonuses. Instead of short-term gratification, longer-term gratification. Instead of linear or simple bonus compensation tied to revenue generation, a review and a monitoring of exactly what constitutes an appropriate incentive long-term for bonus. No golden parachutes, no true up of severance payments based on the last year when you could manipulate the system and get a lot of severance. No more than $25,000 a year in perks for any individual. In other words, no private planes for personal use and all of this. We laid out carefully in our report, and you ought to look at my final report, which came out a week ago. We laid out a series of compensation prescriptions prospectively that we required each of these seven companies to follow. And you're absolutely right. When we laid out these prescriptions the first time, Bank of America and Citigroup borrowed money to get out from under my jurisdiction. Borrowed it from themselves. Bank of America took, I don't know what it was, $3 billion worth of private bonus payments that they were going to pay themselves, mm-hmm. and instead used it to pay back the Treasury so that they wouldn't have to stay in 2010 under my jurisdiction.
Let me follow up and ask you, because I'm looking for a quote here. You used the word outrageous. Earlier you used the term ill-advised. So and you're talking about in real terms, but why is it outrageous? Why?
It was outrageous for the following reasons. I've just said, really. Here's why the pay practices for these seven companies were outrageous, particularly the Wall Street companies, Bank of America and Citigroup, are the two that were under my jurisdiction. AIG, too. And I'll add one more outrageous reason. Too much compensation. Just the aggregate numbers too high. People made too much money.
But in that business, that's the norm.
They made too much money. They made too much money. Now, it may be the norm, but I'm not sure it is the norm. You've got to be careful here. Citigroup was paying, what's his name there, from that unit that they spun off to Occidental, $100 million a year. Mm-hmm. I mean, nobody thought that was sense. Believe in Citigroup, they got rid of him. Mm-hmm. Andrew Hall. Mm-hmm. Too much money. Too much cash. Okay. Too much guaranteed cash. Too short term without tying compensation to longer term performance. Not enough of a link between what you're getting paid and over time how your company performs. Mm-hmm. Basic stuff. I mean, this isn't rocket science.
Right.
And then there's one more that was very problematic, but hands were tied. Too many guaranteed grandfathered compensation payments, mm-hmm. especially at AIG, that mm-hmm. brought Liddy down. That brought him down up there when he testified. That was the end of Liddy. Mm-hmm. Liddy walked in that day and told Congress, I'm doing this for a dollar a year. I don't need it. I'm a great public servant. I'm about to pay my people $168 million mm-hmm. that is guaranteed, contractually obligated that we pay. And they forgot up there. They didn't care about guaranteed contraction.
Right.
They went crazy. We bailed out that company and saved it, and now you're going to take $168 million of the top money that we gave you, and you're going to pay people, two-thirds of whom are gone from the company. It's a contract. I have no guarantee. A terrible problem. Guaranteed long-term payments that used all of my wiles to try and get them to avoid pain.
But let me ask you, I'm trying to rope you into finishing the thought for the quote.
Go ahead.
So it's outrageous.
These are the factors.
You're drawing conclusions, but you're telling us that you can't conclude that there's a corollary, right? But
I can't conclude. You asked me a very specific question. Did pay practices on Wall Street cause the debacle?
Well, you can add contribute if you like.
Yeah.
Contribute to
okay.
the debacle. I assume so.
You assume so.
Congress certainly assumes so. But whether or not there's I'm a lawyer. Whether or not there's a causal connection
right.
between pay practices and the debacle, as opposed to private partnerships going to public, lack of capitalization, the stuff you guys are the experts on, lack of appropriate corporate governance, insufficient federal regulation, I think those that list
right.
is probably more causally linked to the debacle than pay practices on Wall Street.
So are you saying that you believe that it was injurious to these companies? It was not in their best interest to have these compensation packages?
That's correct.
You're saying that?
Yes, I am.
And also, are you saying that it was not in the best interest of the United States?
That I am also saying that.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes. I think Congress delegated to the Secretary of the Treasury, and the Secretary delegated to me under the regulations, mm-hmm. can review compensation practices under the law and determine whether they are, quote, contrary to the public interest, unquote. And I concluded in 2009 and 10
right.
that the existing compensation practices at these companies, and frankly at any other company that has similar compensation practices, mm-hmm. is contrary to the public interest. And as to these seven, mm-hmm. I changed those practices. Mm-hmm. Now, whether other companies voluntarily will change their practices to comply with what I mandated to these seven countries, look at each company. Goldman did.
Right.
Goldman was under such political pressure that Goldman might as well have been an eighth company, because Goldman, I had no jurisdiction over Goldman, but Goldman had me up there to see blank fine four times. Ken, if we do it this way, if we only pay our people $600,000 cash, and if any bonus that they get, they'll get in stock, and they won't get it for 5 years till we see. Am I doing okay? Yeah, you're making some improvements, Lloyd. That's good. That is good. And he did it. Now, whether other companies did it that weren't quite in the public eye, so he wasn't as politically concerned, I can't say.
Now, the banks thought you were going to be tougher. They thought you were going to be more ferocious.
I don't think that's right. I think that the banks, at the end of my tenure, mm-hmm. the law required me to review all 419 mm-hmm. companies mm-hmm. that received TARP assistance, even a dollar, mm-hmm. and to decide, under the statute, whether I should claw back or seek to recoup mm-hmm. monies that those 419 companies paid their employees. I gathered all the data together and I made a few conclusions. First, any company that didn't have anybody in that company earn an annual SAP compensation package of over $500,000. Mm-hmm. Don't even bother me. I haven't got time for that. I haven't got the staff. I mean, if there's nobody in your company, even though you got TARP, if there's nobody in your company that made, nobody, even the CEO that made over $500,000 total in 2009, in 2008 and 9, either one, I'm not interested. You get a waiver. Now as to the remaining 150 companies that have at least one person over 500,000. All right, you've given me the data. Between the time that you got TARP in the fall of 2008 and the time that my program was set up as the Recovery Act in February of 2009, 5 months, 6 month window, you got the TARP money. Did you give away any of that TARP money in bonus compensation? That's what the statute said I should look at. Well, there were 17 companies, we concluded, out of 150. It was outrageous. They got TARP money on November 1, and on November 2, they gave $100 million to their people. I mean, there were 17 companies that were, we found, summa cum laude. But then we discovered the following. Because the statute said, and I can seek reimbursement. Mm-hmm. I can't demand it. I can't sue. I can't subpoena. I can urge, negotiate, plead. Didn't have any enforcement authority. Well, as to those 17 companies, now it's spring 2010. 11 paid back the taxpayer every dime plus interest. Jesus. Maybe they shouldn't have given the top money out. Ridiculous, outrageous, but they pay. Every nickel has come back to the taxpayer. What am I reimbursing? They've already reimbursed the taxpayer. Well, that leaves six companies. At the time they gave the money out, it wasn't illegal. It was ill-advised. It wasn't a good idea. They shouldn't have done it. I concluded, and here's where people say I was too soft on the banks. I concluded that as to those six companies, out of 419, I bit the bullet. I said, I don't think it's fair. They didn't do anything illegal. What am I going to ask the money back? Those people, you're certainly not going to ask the money back from the people who got it. They got it through their company. Maybe the company should pay back the shareholders, or maybe there'll be shareholder lawsuits. I mean, the shareholders were victimized by the top money being used to pay officials. Whether they have a shareholder lawsuit to try and recover that amount and put it back into the value of their stock, that's a derivative shareholder suit. That'll keep him busy. But I don't know. But I just didn't conclude. I concluded, armchair quarterback, I'm going to ask these companies to give the money back. There I was criticized. And my answer is, six companies, and you're asking me that they should give money back, I just don't think that's right. And I wouldn't do it. And the secretary didn't want me to do it either.
Let me ask you one technical question. I want to make sure I understand. When you were looking at compensation, you mentioned to us that you went back as far as 2007, right? With some. So was there any gaming? Did you see them game it to make it look like they weren't paying out?
No, I didn't see it.
Okay. No. So they didn't. You didn't see some huge drop that the guy was getting?
Not at all. Not at all.
Okay.
What I did see, and it was AIG was the prime offender. When I finally got to work in 2009, there were so many of these guaranteed contracts, mm-hmm. employment, come to our firm and we'll give you a guaranteed $300,000 bonus, $500,000 bonus. Mm-hmm. That's why in my final report, I make an important recommendation that you guys should adopt that none of these companies will do. None of them will do it. I said in my final report as I was walking out the door last week, look, you ought to put a so-called break provision in each of your employment contracts with your senior officials. And that break provision says that in a time of a financial crisis, you'll define it. Your board will define what constitutes a financial crisis, not the government. Your board of directors will define it. Build into your employment contracts the provision that in a time of a financial crisis, as defined by the board, the terms and conditions of this contract may be modified as to compensation. And I said in my final report, that's necessary because we found in my doing my work that in all too many cases, particularly with AIG, AIG came and said, well, we have no choice. We have to pay this person an extra million because he has a guaranteed contract and the Constitution, a sanctity of contract, and, the Dartmouth College case and all of this. So we have to pay them. I got most of them to voluntarily give up that contract, but not at AIG. And that's why we have this break provision, which is, I think, would be very valuable. Everybody has a contract. Here's your employment package. Mm-hmm. But if there's a real crisis, we can prospectively change that contract and its terms. Well, we recommended it, and I'll bet you, that was a couple of weeks ago, but I'll bet you nobody's done that.
Right. Well, did you put it together knowing that they wouldn't?
No, I put it together in the hopes that they would, but I have no enforcement authority. I can't mandate that they do it. I can only urge and recommend and blah, blah. And I do think that the corporations, all 419, well, the 17. I think they got it and threw it in the wastebasket. And said, well, that's a good idea. You can't do it. We won't be competitive. No one will come here without a binding, guaranteed contract. The idea that the board can change the terms and automatically vitiate, we can't do that.
Well, their objections were the legal entanglements, right?
Their objection was that it would just cause, was anti-competitive. Mm-hmm. It would prevent them from getting good people because people would go to a firm where there wasn't such a break provision, where they know that what they're going to make is safe and therefore they won't come here.
Did you, you know, in talking about competition, there's actually two questions I want to follow up on. I heard in both of my practice and since I was became part of the commission about the competition from the Wall Street firms, where compensation may have been outrageous, but moving over to the hedge fund industry, where it was bigger in many cases. Did anybody raise that as a reason why their compensation practices were the way they were?
You're a sage. If there's one argument that we heard at Treasury for 16 months, it was that. Mr. Feinberg, if you don't let us pay these dollars the way we want to pay it, we will lose our key people. And you know where they're going to go? They're not going to go across the street to a competitor. They're going to go to Credit Suisse. They're going to go to Barclays. They're going to go to China. That's where they're going to go. China. Everybody's going to China. The number one pushback argument that I heard every day I was there, was that if you don't let us do our thing, you're hurting our competitive ability to repay the taxpayer. And I didn't buy that from the moment I heard it. I've been absolutely, I think, vindicated by not buying it. If you look at the people in these seven companies whose salary compensation packages we fixed in 2009, and then look at whether or not they were still there after we shackled them a little bit in 2010, 85% was still at their desk. 85%. I didn't have time to look as to why the other 15% weren't there. They may have retired. They may have got hit by lightning. I don't know. Maybe some left for competitive reasons. But 85% stayed there. This argument that that ability to compete requires a rising tide for everybody, I find to be baloney. I don't believe it.
Yeah, are those statistics in your report?
Yeah, it's mentioned in the report. There are a lot of reasons, you guys are pros, you know, there are a lot of reasons people don't leave and stay at their desk. Money might be one. I'm comfortable. I've been here 20 years. I know the system. I like my carpool. I like how far I am from work. I like the cafeteria. Where am I going? Where am I going having work here? Is it so easy for me to cross the street when I've got the top brand on my forehead? I mean, does it automatically follow I can go across the street and get another job that's just as comparable in all of this? I've been at a company where we took a bath. I never believed it intuitively, and I'm convinced that that number one argument you guys got to focus on big time is a very dubious proposition. It's oversold as a reason to pay people.
Tell me about, you mentioned the boards of directors and governance. Did you see any evidence that compensation committees or the boards of any of these companies or the ones that weren't on your jurisdiction actively tried to manage this process?
No.
And were, it was basically an inside job, I guess.
No, I never saw that. Now, you ought to talk to Neil Wolin, Deputy Secretary. Neil is the world's expert on corporate governance reform and why corporate governance reform is a good idea and say on pay and all of this stuff. That was not part of my jurisdiction. I stayed away from it. He's the resource.
Yeah.
622-1080. Direct line. I know it by heart.
Impressive.
And as one other question, there's been a popular mythology, and there's a lot written on, you know, the financial rents, I think it's called, as to the excess, supposed excess compensation paid on Wall Street compared to historical relationship between Wall Street and industrial America, and the changes that have happened in that, the increase, the disproportionate increase in compensation on Wall Street versus the rest of of highly paid industrial companies. Did you see any evidence, or did you give any credence to the theory that the compensation structures on Wall Street, being as generous as they were, may have drained from other pursuits, you know, inventing a cure for cancer or new subatomic particles or anything like that?
No, you know, I didn't see that. But I will tell you, look at the report. The soaring gap between Wall Street pay and GM pay, it is astounding. GM, I grew up, GM, I mean, that is about the greatest company.
Yeah.
I think this is right. You can check the stats. I think the top three people at Bank of America, Citigroup, or AIG got more money than the top, more compensation than the top 25 people at GM. I mean, in my narrow role, nobody really cared about GM or Chrysler. The only thing the press was interested in is, what am I going to do about Bank of America, Citigroup, and AIG? The other four companies, the pay scale was so modest relative to them that everybody was focusing on Wall Street. And I can't tell you whether GM lost good people or couldn't secure good people because they went to work on Wall Street. But I can tell you that it was an eye-opener for me to see the difference in compensation between the Wall Street-related firms and industrial America. Both mirroring and anticipating problems that Wall Street caused in the crisis. I mean, say what you want about GM and Chrysler. They had nothing to do with creating the crisis, I don't think.
Yeah, no, I don't think you,
I mean,
you can pin it on the Corvair.
That's right.
Yeah.
The pay practices at GM and Chrysler, when you look at my report, Jesus, I mean, whatever you want to say about a top official making $600,000 compared to Ben Moshe making $10.5 million, I mean,
could be an associate, a senior associate at a law firm on Wall Street and make that much.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, Lex, do you have anything
else? Just a couple questions.
Go ahead.
You highlighted publicly the $10 million per person character. How many folks were in that level of stress?
Very few. Once we got through them?
No, before you started.
No, before you started.
Oh! You'd have to look. It's right there.
Yeah.
A fair number at Bank of America, Citigroup, and AIG. Mm-hmm. Only the CEOs, probably, at GM and Chrysler. And at Chrysler Financial, GMAC. I don't know how many were. Double digit. Before we started, maybe the seven companies together had 30 people.
Mm-hmm.
After we were through, they were probably...
In that level, the 10?
10 or more, before we started. And after we started, I'd say that dropped from 30 or so, probably down to 2 or 3.
Mm-hmm. I know that Warren Buffett had told the FCIC that in the trends that he had watched with compensation, the more public the compensation packages become, the more executives look at them and then believe that they should be getting the same thing. To what extent did you find that they're all very knowledgeable about what this top level is getting, or is it very siloed?
Very siloed.
It is. Okay.
So siloed that we could never get comparative data on the car industry.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't get it. We looked everywhere. GM and Chrysler. Well, let's check as to what you're getting paid relative to Ford or Honda or Toyota. We couldn't even get Ford's data.
Hmm.
But you didn't have subpoena power?
No.
Okay.
We do, and it's hard for us to get stuff. So.
And the last thing I wanted to ask you is, the way Congress set up the task that you were given, could they have set it up differently after you went through it, that it would have been more helpful to you, more helpful to the project?
No.
Okay.
Congress set this up and gave me jurisdiction over seven companies.
Mm-hmm.
some have said, wouldn't it have been more helpful and more broad-based and a better research tool? Instead of 7, you had 70, mm-hmm. so you could do a more broader mm-hmm. regulation. I don't think so. I think Congress will not do this again. It was a unique response to a debacle of unprecedented magnitude. And I don't think Congress will soon insinuate the federal government into setting pay practices. It's not like I had jurisdiction to monitor, you know, and regulate generally. I had to calculate what each senior executive is actually going to make. That's why there was such interest in what I was doing. I mean, in one sense, I only had 25 people, the top 25 people at 7 companies. That's 175 people. What's everybody getting excited about here? It's sort of a thimble. But it was, I think, what attracted such interest is, well, no, it may be only 175 people, but unlike vanilla prescriptions tied to performance, no guarantees, long-term, no much cash, but he's taking those prescriptions and then translating them into actual liquidated compensation for each person. Gee, this is sort of interesting. What is that guy worth? Feinberg says he's worth $4 million. That's sort of interesting. And I don't think Congress will do that again. And I'm not sure it should either, to tell you the truth. But anyway.
Well, thank you very much.
Anything we should have asked you that we didn't?
You guys should really, in your jurisdiction, you should focus on this issue about America's ability to compete. And if you don't play ball with foreign competition and others in the domestic arena, you are shackling the ability of American, of corporate America, to compete. That is the big argument made by corporate America, and I don't buy it. I think it's much too simplistic, and it can't be. I don't think it's been proven, and I think we, in our limited way, we proved the opposite. It's still there.
Are pay practices, did you look at pay practices with both U.S. branches of offshore financial institutions and European or Asian practices with respect to the same institutions? I mean, how do they compare?
We did, and we found that Asian practices, to the extent that you can find out anything about them, are much more restrictive than America. And Toyota's top guy, I think, makes $600,000, as far as we can tell. Mm-hmm. Honda, the Japanese car company, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If we wanted to get to any data through the research that you all worked on, who would we contact?
Pat Gagans, the special master at Treasury.
Okay. She's taken it over.
She's there now. She's doing it in the Office of Financial Stability.
So
I don't have her number. But they had all of it, all the reports, okay. All of our determinations, our rationale. It's public.
Right.
It's probably online, frankly, and you can get that, and she'll give you the access code.
Okay, good. Is there anything that, the fact that we do have subpoena power, is there anything in particular that you wish you had been able to find out that you didn't in this area?
Just what the Asian car companies make.
I don't think our subpoena was
I don't think
Tokyo,
you need that.
So
I don't think
okay.
you need that. No, I think we did. We managed.
Great. Very good. Thank you.